Hey, so my guest today is Peter Frampton. When I think about Frampton, I am immediately transported back to my teens. When Peter's musical juggernaut of a live album, Frampton Comes Alive, it took the world and my life by storm with these anthemic songs like Do You Feel Like We Do, Show Me the Way, Lines on My Face, and Baby I Love Your Way. I cannot think about those songs without also hearing what became his signature talk box sound vibrating through my body. Known in his earlier years for a fierce talent as a guitarist and musician, co-founder of one of the first rock supergroups, Humble Pie, and a collaborator with everyone from George Harrison, Bowie, and Jerry Lee Lewis to then Stones bassist Bill Wyman and Ringo Starr. That album, Frampton Comes Alive, it changed everything. It became a global phenomenon and best-selling live album for decades. And following on the heels of that album just months later came this equally iconic shirtless cover on Rolling Stone, shot by Francesco Scavullo and accompanied by a feature story written by a then-young Cameron Crowe. Peter's ascendancy, powerful as it was, came with a very dark side. It recast him as a pop star, an idol or sex symbol, an icon in the industry that was built to take advantage of just such a phenomenon. And the years that followed took Peter, his life, his mental health, and his career into some pretty scary and lonely places. Before that childhood friend, David Bowie, would step back in about a decade or so later with an invitation that set in motion almost a reclamation, a renewed sense of self and passion and direction that fueled Peter to step back into music in a way that nourished rather than emptied him. Much of Peter's story is beautifully shared in his memoir, Do You Feel Like I Do, which I devoured, actually in audio, hearing him tell it in his own voice. In our conversation, many of the pivotal and wonderful moments and stories along the way, as well as some new revelations, drop into the conversation. And as we spoke, Frampton also shared his experience living with an incurable degenerative muscular disease, inclusion body myositis, and how, as he described, he's got these three clocks running in his life that are essentially ticking away as he's unable to travel, hoping to be able to make it to the final few stops of a farewell concert that he planned to play back where he grew up and while he's still able. Really excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that your loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. Really fun to be able to just spend a little bit of time with you. I'm a huge lover of music. And also maybe of stories about music and kindness. We had Jimmy Vaughn in the studio a little while back, and he was sharing some stories. And I remember hearing a story about his little brother Stevie, mm-hmm. and how he acquired this sort of famous 65 Strat, walking by a pawn shop with his wife Lenny, sees it in the window. It was before he had broken, so it was $350 because it was really beat up, but he didn't have any money. So Lenny sort of circulated around and got $50 donation from all of his friends, bought it for him, gave it to him, and then he stayed up all night writing Lenny a love song to her.
Aww.
And it's interesting because when I think about one of the guitars you become iconic for using, the 54 Les Paul, there's an interesting sort of similar, really kindness-based origin story of how you came to even own that guitar.
Well, the whole thing is like a fairy story, really, from beginning, and there's no end, and it's still the gift that keeps giving. So yes, I was with Humble Pie. It was 1970. I was playing Fillmore West, and I had just swapped my SG, my Gibson solid body SG Gibson Les Paul for a 62 for a 335. Well, unfortunately, we played at such a loud level, Humble Pie, that every time I turned my my volume up to solo, my solos sounded like, ooh, ooh, ooh. It was just a mass of feedback, And I was just, and the band were looking at me like, what's going on? So anyway, after I came off, there was a friend of mine there that I knew from San Francisco, and he's Mark Mariana. And friend of his had told him that I was having problems. So he came down the next night. He said, I couldn't help but notice that you were having problems. He said, would you like to borrow one of my guitars? I said, oh gosh, yeah, that'd probably be good. So he said, it's a Les Paul. I said, oh, I'm not too good. I like SGs, but Les Pauls are a bit too fat sounding for me. So I said, but you know what? Anything is going to be better. So he brings it to the hotel the following morning to the coffee shop. He opens it up in the coffee shop, and it's just come back from Gibson, having been refinished in 1970. It was a 1954 guitar. And he had plumbed it for three humbuckers instead of the P90 original pickups on the guitar, and sent it back to Gibson. They'd refinished it. And I just took it up to my room in the hotel, and I was playing it, and I just felt like this was the perfect neck. Everything just felt so, and I played it on stage that night and for the rest of the nights for the show at Fillmore, and it was, my feet didn't touch the ground, and my solos were nice and loud. So I was just, and then after, at the end of the show, or end of the run of the shows, I said to Mark, I gave it back to him, and I said, I know what you're going to say, but I got to ask it anyway. Would you sell it? And he said, no, I'm going to give it to you. And I mean, I'm getting goosebumps right now. That was the beginning of the fairy story, that he gave me the guitar. I have given him so many number ones of all the different runs of Gibson guitars that I've been lucky enough for them to do for me. So he always gets number one. He's going to get it. There's another one coming out soon. He's going to get that one too. And so I played it from 1970, 1980. We had this horrible accident, plane crash in Caracas, Venezuela. And we believed all the stage gear was gone, everything, PA, monitors, backline, guitars, keyboards. And so when my tech went down a week later, we were not in the country anymore. We'd already moved on to Panama. And when my tech went down there a week later, he said, there's nothing left. It's just, you know, there's a picture in the book of shows you what was left. And so anyway, that was it. So for 30 years, every time someone came to me and I had a black Les Paul in my hand, oh, is that it? Is that it? And I'd go, no, it's not the one. And then, as I said, 30 years later, I open up an email from my info@frampton.com, and there it is today. It's alive, you know. So I screamed and I looked at it and I said, it's mine. That is mine. I could see it because they took the pickups out. I know everything about that guitar, inside, outside, you know, inside the knob, the volumes, everything, because I've taken it all apart so many times myself to clean it and update it or whatever. And I said, that's mine. But I wasn't going to tell them that. So anyway, there was a gray area of 2 years where the guitar was owned by someone on the island of Curaçao, and he stashed it away. It was too, he knew what it was, obviously. Then his son, the next generation, that's why there's the 30 years, wants to play guitar and says, Dad, can I take that guitar in to be fixed? It's not playing too well. And so he said, yeah, go ahead. And they didn't think about it. The luthier he took it to knew as soon as he opened the case, he went, and he said, you know, he didn't say anything. He just said, leave it with me overnight and I'll get it playable for you. So the kid comes back following day, and the luthier says, you know what this guitar is, don't you? Whose this is? And the kid just closed the case and ran out. So that was it. We knew who had it, but we didn't know where he lived. So in the end, the kid wanted a new guitar within 18 months, 2 years. And so he asked the luthier, I'll get rid of it for $5,000 because I want to buy a new guitar. So basically, then it's still stolen merchandise. So the luthier goes to the one of the offices in the government of Curaçao and says, you know, I think the government needs to buy this. It'll be great for the island of Curaçao. If the government buys it back, Peter can't put you in jail. You know, I didn't want to put anybody in jail anyway. I just wanted it back at that point. And basically, the Minister of Tourism and the luthier bring the guitar back to me 32 years later, and we filmed the whole thing. You can see it on YouTube. It's me getting my guitar back, you know, and it's about 10 minutes, and it's a wonderful video. I love it. I watch it every now and again because I remember exactly how I was feeling that day, you know, knowing that it was coming back, you know, it was, and then, of course, we went straight from the hotel with everybody to Gibson. There was, you know, all these guitar aficionados, Walter Carter and George from down here. So everyone's like looking at it and saying, yes, it's a 54, 55. So everyone was saying, we knew what it was, but I just wanted everybody to see it once and for all and say, yes, this is what I've always said it is. And so they kept it for about a month, Gibson, the custom shop. and they made it playable again. Unfortunately, the electronics weren't good anymore and pickups weren't good. So all my friends, I didn't know I had so many, Les Paul lovers, were sending me Patton Applied for pickups. And oh, I can't thank enough people. And basically, it's more time sensitive now than it ever was, I think. And it made its debut at our Comes Alive 35 concert at the Beacon Theater in Manhattan. And the stage went dark right before Do You Feel. My tech put the guitar on a stand right in the middle of the stage, and all the Super Trooper lights hit it at once, and the audience went nuts. And it was the guitar's night.
That's beautiful. So I'm also a lifelong New Yorker, and I'm pretty sure that actually my stepbrother was in the audience at the Beacon that night.
Oh, great.
Because I remember him saying, you know, I played guitar when I was a kid, and I had this early 70s Bone Strat that I remember, and I was like a dumb kid and I needed a little bit of money. So I sold it to him, and he still has it, and it's beautiful. So we kind of like both love guitars, and I remember him sharing how beautiful that show was and like seeing you back on stage, you know, with the 54 Les Paul. There's something kind of magical.
Yeah. It's likened to my career. It disappeared, and so did my career for a long time, due to many things in my control and out of my control. And as soon as it came back, things started happening again. So it was, well, things had started happening again already, but it was just icing on the cake, you know.
Yeah.
To have it back. And then I remember the first Anthony Mason from CBS Sunday Morning. They were filming the return of the guitar and me first playing it. And he interviewed me in the bus before I went on into the stage. And he said, "So how do you feel about playing it for the first time again?" I said, "I'm really nervous that I'm going to make a mistake." And I did. In the intro, thank goodness CBS cut that part out. It was very nice of them. But I got the board tape and I couldn't believe. I was so nervous about playing it again. It was the star of the night, you know, and it just meant so much to me that I just made a little flub on that intro. And I never do that, obviously. I played that number for nearly 50 years. So. But anyway, it showed how important the guitar was to me.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you hear, I have a good friend who's a photographer also, and everyone's always asking him, like, tell me about like, what should I buy? What camera is going to make me a better photographer and all this? And it's the same in music, I think, where people are always like, you know, what are the pedals? What are the guitars? What's the equipment that's going to make me a better X player? And, right. and you know, the rote line is always, it's not about the equipment. It's about you, you know, and still every once in a while you find something where like you connect with a guitar or drum set or you know, like whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's almost spiritual.
Yep. And because Mark had taken that guitar and he said when he bought it secondhand, it was a horrible green color. Who would have wanted a green Les Paul? I don't know. Green tambourine, but not green Les Paul. So anyway, so, you know, he had sanded it. Took the paint remover and then he sanded it and sanded it and sanded it and sanded it. And now the neck is smaller than a regular Les Paul. And I have small hands. So for me, it was like he'd sanded it to order for me. And Matt Gibson is working on another version of the Phoenix. We're going to put one that's going to be out there forever now. Which is, I'm so thankful. And they sent me two prototypes a few months ago, and they were phenomenal. I said, "Oh, this is so great." I said, "The only thing is the neck just is, it's so close." I said, "But there's just a little bit, you know, that." And then I explained to them how it got that way. And he said, "Bring it in. We're going to scan it again." So they scanned it again. And he called me the other day and he said, "It's an eighth of an inch or a tenth of an inch narrower at a 0.0, whatever it was, at the nut. And it's a little narrow all the way down. I said, oh, so you can't do that. He said, no, we're going to do it for you. He said, not normally, but they are. They're going to make it just, it's only a little tiny, tiny, yeah. But a little tiny, tiny on a guitar neck is a huge amount, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you feel everything, you know? It's amazing what you can actually pick up.
So I thank Gibson. We're under new ownership. JC is taken over, and we are so thrilled for Gibson.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm excited for to sort of like see the next the evolution of the famous Phoenix now, maybe available in different ways to more people.
And it's not going to be a hugely expensive piece either. Yeah. Like, we didn't want that.
Yeah. You know, the guitar is sort of legendary. It's you know, you played it on stage early on. It's the guitar that ended up, you know, being featured on Frantic Comes Alive and all over the place. And you were playing from a very early age, starting with the banjolele and home, and eventually doing. It sounds like you bumped into, you met Bill Wyman of the Stones pretty early in your teens. That leads to session playing with some of the incredible people. You end up with Humble Pie. You and Steve Marriott start that around 69-ish, from what I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, what's happening in your life and your head is like, I love this thing. It's all I want to do. But in your mind, the identity is a guitarist. Like, this is my jam. But the world kept wanting you to be something else. And then eventually when Frampton Comes Alive, you know, like comes out in 76, it's like the world says, ooh, like, this is our chance, you know?
Right.
And I guess nobody really, well, let me not assume that, actually. It feels like, you know, you'd been out there in a solo career for, you know, a couple of years before that.
Yeah.
Doing well, but when Frampton Comes Alive, like, it changes the paradigm of everything around you at once. And it seems like it was also a bit of a mixed blessing for you.
Yes. Being known and getting every gig that I got, whether it be a band or a session or whatever, because of my guitar playing from a very young age. And then, I mean, I'm going to have to mention The Herd there, because I joined The Herd in England, which was, in the end, we had three real big hits and were very popular in Europe. But I was picked out to be the singer by the managers and writers of the songs because of my looks. And I'm going to use the word only because Pete Townsend used it to me the other day. And he mentioned that my beauty got in the way. And I liken that to a lot of it usually happens to women actresses who are phenomenal actresses, but their looks are just so great that it overtakes, and everyone thinks less of their acting because of the way they look. It's such a weird thing. And so anyway, the thing that happened when Comes Alive came out was that, because of my looks, I ended up on front cover of Rolling Stone, all these people, this, that, ba boom, ba dee. And, you know, pretty much just about every time they got me to take my shirt off and stuff that I should never have done, you know. But, you know, I needed to learn the word no a little earlier in my career. But, and then unfortunately, that kind of took over. And after Comes Alive, which is, I'll say it myself, there's some incredible guitar playing on Comes Alive. I don't usually play my own trumpet, but I listen to it now every now and again. I'll hear a track on the radio and I go, wow, it's not bad. It's pretty good. And there's people on the internet analyzing my solos. And so I thought, wow, maybe I am pretty good. So I took a big hit mentally from all that, and it was coupled with the fact that I was kind of pushed into doing a follow-up album way too soon, when you've become the biggest selling album of all time, which Comes Alive was for 2 years, you're only as good as your last record, they say. Didn't need to do one in the next 4 years. The Eagles, I always use the Eagles as a great example. You think they've had 30 studio albums. I think it's 7. And the rest are best songs and live or whatever. And they only ever go near the studio because they can't stand each other. But also until they all know that their level of quality of song is extraordinarily high, because why bother going into the studio until you've got an extraordinarily good song, you know, and a bunch of them. So I had 6 months, I had 6 years to write the material for Comes Alive, from Rock On with Humble Pie, the Shine On came from that. Then I cherry picked from 4 of my own solo records and a Rolling Stones number. And, well, that was on one of my solo records. And, you know, so now everyone's is living by the old rules of, well, you've just had a hit record. No, I haven't just had a hit record. I've had the biggest selling record of all time record. So there's no rush to go back in the studio. But I was rushed. And 6 months later, I'm in the studio again. And with substandard material, hating it, not wanting to be in the studio, wanting to, you know, be writing with a lot of other great writers. I mean, at that time, for the follow-up of Comes Alive, if I'd have just got out of my own way for a second or two, every producer in the world would have wanted to work with me. Every great songwriter would have wanted to write with me. And I discounted all that and just went with, well, I've done it all myself so far, so I'm going to do it all myself. But I needed help right then, because how was I going to be able to come up with that great material and follow up a live album with a studio album? It doesn't work. You know, it's very, very hard to do.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems like also for you, I mean, it feels like playing live is the thing that fills you more than anything else.
Yeah.
You know, so the idea of like, okay, so let's pull back from that to go into a mode of creation, which also is not the thing which really, you know, it's great, but it's not the thing like you feel like you're here to do. And you're young at that point also. I mean, yes, like I know you said, yes, I played a role in this, I made decisions. But, you know, come on, you're what, 25, 26 at that point?
Yeah.
And the world is sort of like, you know, like meeting you and saying, and then you have people in the industry saying, well, this is the appropriate next move. It's really hard to say, well, I know better, you know, for anybody at that age in any domain.
Well, yes, because I thought, well, these guys are really experienced. I'm not, management, record company, agent, whatever. They know. I needed to know what to do. I had no clue. I was adrift. I was a one-man band, basically. There's no got three other guys to talk to. And I remember being in Humble Pie, we used to say no a lot, you know, because we would talk amongst ourselves, you know. And nobody knew except me what to do at that point, because no one had been there, as Cameron Crowe said, my dear buddy. They asked him, what just happened to Peter Frampton? And he said he was strapped to the nose cone of a rocket. He was shot off, landed on the moon. He got off and there was nobody else there. And that's how I felt. You know, I felt like all these people are advising me, but they haven't been here. They don't know. They've never handled an artist that's got the biggest selling record of all time, you know. So how do they know? But I succumbed to advice that was from their agenda, which was, this goose can lay another golden egg. Let's get that egg happening.
Yeah, get it while the getting's hot, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax.
and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi's Starter Pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash, and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. It's interesting also. So Cameron Crowe, the album comes out January, I guess, 76.
Yes.
You end up on the front cover of Rolling Stone, and sort of this, you know, like famous Gavulo shirtless shot. And then Cameron writes the byline, and the title of that is The Pretty Power Rocker.
Right.
But it's really interesting because when you read the piece that he wrote, it doesn't match up with the headline.
No.
Because he was actually, even at that moment, he was pretty insightful. Like, he saw in you conflict, inner conflict and tension, and kind of wrote about it.
Yeah.
But that's not really what made it out into the world.
No. No, that's Jan Werner. Thank you. I don't think he likes me. But anyway, it was great. Cameron and I got to do a Zoom thing on the day of the book came out together, and we hadn't spoken in a while. It was just so great to talk with him, because we went on vacation together. We were real close buddies for a long time, and still are, you know. And we've just said as soon as the all clear sounds, we've got to meet up again, and I got to buy him a nice meal.
Man, I think a lot of people are feeling that way these days, right?
Yes.
So on the outside looking in, there's a huge phenomenon happening around you. You know, it's just like a, well, like Cameron wrote, you know, like you've been strapped to the front of a rocket ship and it's just exploding and taking off. But behind the scenes, as you've shared, things, you're struggling, you're being pushed in directions which aren't necessarily where you want to go. And the next probably close to a decade or so, as you shared, it's a struggle for you. You know, thrown into the middle of that, you know, like a devastating car wreck in the Bahamas, pain medication, drugs, being, you know, having people who are very close to you essentially take from you. And you're simultaneously trying to create, you know, you're putting out new work, but stuff isn't working the way that it did, especially when you've got this thing, you know, like Frampton Comes Alive as the metric to compare. How do you compare anything to that after that?
I know. It's like Alanis Morissette, bless her. She's had recent success, and I'm so thrilled for her because it's devastating. I liken her Pill album to Comes Alive in a way. You know, it's just, get it away from me. You know, it's a blessing and a curse, you know, and she's very, very talented, and I'm so thrilled for her. I really am. And it was, for me, it was the 80s were a period where I felt that Comes Alive would put me on the moon, and everything that came after that seemed to have a cross in it, cross over it. You know, I'm in You, Too Soon, Bad Cover, you know, front cover of Rolling Stone, Shirt Off. You know, as Andrew Oldham just read my book, my dear friend Andrew, who was the Stones' first manager, he managed Humble Pie and was the record label. At the bottom of the letter, he says, "Fuck Scavullo." So it's you know, I love Andrew. He's always to the point, and dear friend for so many years, and. The 80s was a period of, not only did my looks take me all the way down, but I felt like when I left Humble Pie, I felt like I wasn't off the ladder. I was a couple of rungs up because people, especially in America and England, because people knew me from Humble Pie. So I've got a built-in audience, small though it may be. I've got a small audience, but I felt that after I'm in You and the movie Sgt. Pepper came out, I went down not just off the ladder, but I was like underneath the ground. I'd gone down the rungs beneath the ground level I was on. And I had to dig myself out of a hole to even get on the first rung again. And obviously, it wasn't a terrific time for me. It was devastating and financially, and everything, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, money was taken from me. Not that it's happened to a lot of people, but I was in dire straits, and I'm not talking about Mark Knopfler, you know, so it wasn't a great time, but because of my upbringing and my resilience that I get from, mainly from my mother, I think, but my dad as well, I wasn't about to say this is the end. I've always brushed myself off and whatever I have to do. And of course, David Bowie, Dave, as I know him, came to my rescue because we went to school together. And he knew me as the guitar player. Not, he was the singer guy. I was the guitar player, you know. And so he saw what had happened. And he saw that I'd come out of it, and I'd just made my first record for Atlantic. Amit, thank you very much. Dear Amit, miss him dearly. And Dave heard that, and he said, "Oh man, I love the guitar playing on this album, Premonition it was." And I said, "Oh, thanks." And he said, "Would you come and play for me?" And I said, "Finally?" we played on the same stage the same night, but not at the same time for so many years. And I said, "We're going to play together." And he said, "Yeah, yeah." So I go to Switzerland, make the album, Never Let Me Down. And while I'm there, he asked me to, would I come on the tour, Glass Spider tour, and be one of the two guitar players? And I said, yes, I will. I would love. Now this is a dream come true. This is what I've always wanted. Ever since I saw, as you're reading the book, as I walked into the school and saw this band on the stage when I was 12, with my dad, my mom, on a Saturday, and I saw the Conrads playing on the steps of the entrance of the school. And I wasn't going to the school yet. It was the next year. And I just was mesmerized by this guy playing the sax with a crew cut, or whatever he was back then. And I just looked up at Dad and I said, Dad, who's that? He said, oh, that's Jones. He's very musical and he's very artistic, you know, that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, Dad, I want to be him. So that was it. And so when I first made a, you know, from that moment, and then we met at school and had a great friendship for his entire life. And to from that moment to being on stage in stadiums around the world, he reintroduced me and gave me this wonderful gift of reintroducing me as the guitar player, the musician around the world, which was, that's such a huge gift, you know. And he knew exactly what he was. I didn't realize at the time until it actually was started to happen. And all of a sudden, people are talking about Peter, the guitar player, again. And it was, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just your sort of reemergence at a larger scale into music. It was in the way that you wanted to be known, you know, or it was for the thing that was deepest in your heart. You know,
yes.
not for appearances, not for sort of like the pop idol type of thing, but for the just like deeply melodic, amazing guitar playing, which was such a part of your DNA from the youngest age. It's like a beautiful full circle moment there.
It was. And, you know, I still thank him and, yeah, miss him dearly, as we all do. But he gave me my confidence back. And I think once I got my confidence back, then I called Steve Marriott and I said, let's get back together. And unfortunately that didn't work out. But we did some great music together. And then unfortunately we lost Steve. He passed away. And so I thought, well, that's another thing, you know, that I've got to, that was devastating, obviously. But then I just called John Regan, my bass player, for the last band that I had together, and I said, let's go tour. Let's go do some clubs. 92. And we started in, I think in February. We did 6 weeks of clubs. We ended up doing 6 months of touring. It kept on getting extended. And we ended up back in Detroit playing Pine Knob, headlining, you know, and gosh, that was a year. 92 was the year. It was just like building it back again, like slowly but surely, the right way, live, with my forte, you know. And by the end of the year, we could have gone on touring forever, it seemed, but then it was time to make another record. And I had the confidence to do it again now. And I felt like I was no longer competing with myself and the old The Comes Alive guy. I was now just, you know, building back a career as a musician. And it was the best period in my life, that paying my dues again, not being wealthy at all, never done anything for money in my life. It's always been because of the music, and it worked. And gradually, it took a long time, but you never stop paying your dues.
Isn't that the truth, right?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
It's funny, I had, I don't know if you know the author, Kate DiCamillo. She writes these beautiful books.
I've heard of
her. And we had her in the studio a little while back. And at some point in the conversation, this notion of the way she writes and the way, for her, her creative process, the final act of creation is actually an act of connection. She feels like the final act of creation doesn't happen until the person actually reads her words, whether it's a six-year-old kid or an adult reading it to them. I wonder if, and I've been really curious about people where there's either sort of like a really strong emphasis towards process, like it is just the expressive act that makes you feel like I'm doing the thing I'm here to do, versus knowing how that lands and that sense of like, no, I'm having a conversation. There's a dialogue going on between me and one other person, a million other people. Do you have a sense for where you fall sort of in that spectrum?
Yes. I'm working on a friend's track right now. He's asked me to play some guitar. And I've been doing that under COVID. People keep sending me tracks and I give, send me as much as you can so I can get keep the fingers moving, you know? And there's a moment when it happens. When I play a solo and I go, no, that's not it. No, next one. Put it down for a second. Have a cup of tea. Come back. Play. Wow. What happened? What happened in that moment? Why is it so different? It's because I think I disconnect. Like it's the disconnection from everybody on the side of the stage. When I go on stage, and it's the connection with the audience. And it's that, it's the same moment of creation when I'm playing that solo where all my thoughts disappear. And I am playing from my heart, my soul. And I'm not thinking. And I go at the end of it, I go, how did I play that? Where did that come from? And those are the moments I treasure the most. And some days I'll be sitting there and do 16 takes and I'll go back and I'll listen to the first take and I'll go, wow, that was really good. You know, but I keep thinking I can do it better, you know. But yes, I agree with her in as much as I think that my connection is actually the moment when I'm totally bereft of all control. Which is, and it's coming from somewhere I don't know, deep inside me. And the same thing happens on stage. As soon as I leave the side of the stage, I have nobody to tell me what to do at all or give me advice or whatever. And it's up to me. And this adrenaline kicks in and I become a different person. I become a creator on stage, you know, and I never play the same thing twice in solos. I can't do it because I can't remember what I played, but that's not the part. I wouldn't want to know, remember what I played, because each performance is another painting, you know, each performance is an audio painting for me. And I want to make sure I don't play what I played yesterday. I want to create a new something, you know, and that's why the audience being there and letting me know they like what I just did. And I like what I just did anyway. You know, it's like that feedback between me and the audience. And it's this, they create my adrenaline, you know. And I think, especially with my IBM, inclusion body myositis, which is, you know, is affecting my fingers and my legs and my arms and everything right now, I rely a lot on adrenaline, you know. And you know, maybe if I'm just playing for the sake of playing and practicing, you know, I find it a little difficult in some areas maybe that I didn't used to. And then I go downstairs and or go to my studio and I put up a track and I play on it and all my thoughts disappear. And all of a sudden it happens, you know, and it's indescribable, the feeling when that happens, because it's like, it's not all the time. But it is every time I go on stage. But that's why I think I'm a better live performer than I am in the studio, because I hate red light fever. You know, that's why I love recording at home and when I'm not supposed to be recording. When I'm not supposed to be playing that solo is when I play the best solo or come up with the best new chorus or something.
Yeah, isn't it always like that? It's kind of amazing. It's interesting to hear you say, on the one hand, you never play the same thing the same way twice. But I've also heard you say you're very much a perfectionist. I mean, you shared that a few times just in our conversation, which is kind of interesting, because on the one hand, you'd figure the perfectionist says, let me just take this riff, this lick, this song, and practice the exact same thing over and over until it is 100% perfect. And I think you have that in you. But then at the same time, you're like, I don't ever want to do that, which is this really interesting tension.
It's like my dear guitar tech, Darren Hurst. We've been working together a couple of years now, and he's wonderful. And when they ask, he said, when people ask me about your playing, I say, the man is always on the edge of falling off the cliff because he's searching, you know. And sometimes there might be a little green note there, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's searching for that new piece of something that I can create. You know?
Yeah, I love that. You mentioned IBM, inclusion body myositis, which from what I understand is a degenerative muscular disease, which I guess it started to touch down in your life 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that.
Yes, it's probably more like 8 or 9 years ago now.
Okay.
Yeah,
I mean, part of me wonders, and I know you have shared and you write about that, you know, this, it's a progressive condition for you. You know, for a long time, it has been progressing very slowly, and you've been involved with John Hopkins and some trials, and and it's helped. When you think about the fact that the thing that you feel like you're here to do is to play music and to play it live, how do you do that dance where you have this thing that is perpetually out there and now part of your life? And you also know that the one thing that you love more than anything else is to be out front and with people and playing. Do you forgive your desire to be perfect when you're playing all the time and still show up in front of other people? Or how do you grapple with this?
Well, I said to Ken Levitan, my manager, great. And he's a wonderful, wonderful man, and great ideas. And it's really rejuvenated my career. And so I'm very thankful for him. I said to him, I've fallen 3 times now, and the last time was bad. And I said, I think we ought to be careful with with what we, this was before the finale tour, I think we ought to be careful with what we book. And live wise. And he said, well, let's make this your farewell tour and it can go on for as long as you want so that you can get to all the countries you want to go to. And hopefully your IBM will allow you to do that. So we did that, but and the finale tour was, I don't have words. The people, audiences were unbelievable. And I'm so thankful that I got to do it. But unfortunately, we got cut short because of COVID, good reason, obviously. So now I'm dealing with, we've all got clocks. I have two other clocks. We have the COVID clock before the all clear, which isn't anywhere near happening now. Yet we have our life clock. And I have my IBM clock. And I just hope that they all work together so that I can go to Europe. Because I've got to go home. I'm American. I'm a US citizen, but I'm also a UK citizen. And so we had the Albert Hall booked, you know, May 31st this year. And we'd all left in our calendars, all the band. And when every day I would get up and, you know, it comes up, notifies you where you are, today you're in Paris. And no, I'm not. And then the May 31st came up and we all called each other that day. We're supposed to be at the Albert Hall. I said, I know. I didn't mean that when I stop playing, everybody else has to stop playing, but that's sort of what happened, you know. And so, yes, it's hard to deal with that side of it because I don't know whether I'll be able to play live again. It all depends on these clocks that have to work together in the right possible way.
Yeah. Well, hoping that it all does.
Me too. Me too. Yeah. I'm the eternal optimist. People say, you know, well, how can you be optimistic? I said, well, I'm playing good, you know, I'm playing really well. I'm enjoying playing. That's all that matters right now is that I'm enjoying playing. Down the road, I'll deal with it when I get there.
Yeah, it's kind of like I know what I feel and what I'm capable of in this moment.
Right.
You know, and the more I can just keep focusing my attention there.
Yes.
The future will give whatever the future gives. But in this moment, you know, in this 5 minutes, yeah, like things are actually good.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Feels like a good place for us to come full circle in our conversation as well. So we are hanging out in this container of the Good Life Project. If I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To live a good life? Well, now things have changed over the years. A good life right now for me is to spend time with my children and family. I was an absent father because of what I did and do for a living up until a very short time ago. So that's all I want now. I'm 70 years old. I've had an incredibly colorful life so far. And I'm so thankful. I can't ask for much more. So yes, I want to be the best dad possible from now on until I leave the planet. And I'm actually going to see my granddaughter for the very first time. She was born April 6th. And I'm writing this song and it has the line where it's, I can't reach through the screen, but I can hold her in my dream. You know, and that's, I want to, but the reality of holding her in my hands, not through the screen, you know. And Wednesday's going to be a very good day.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.